Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wilco Drilling PLC fourth quarter 2014 conference call. My name is Raji, and I'll be your coordinator for today's conference. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. However, at the end of the presentation, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions. If at any time you need assistance, please press star zero on your telephone keypad and you'll be connected to an operator. I'll now hand you over to your host, John Oliver Bryce, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Raji. I'm John Bryce, and welcome to Wilco Drilling Q4 2014 earnings call. For those of you who have access to the internet, we will be roughly following the Q4 presentation, which was added to our website this morning. The agenda for the call then is we'll touch on highlights. We'll go into the numbers in more detail. We'll speak about operations. We'll talk about the market. We'll summarize, and then we'll have a Q&A session at the end. Also on the call today is CFO Ian Wilson. If you do have the presentation in front of you, starting on page five. The highlights for the quarter, a very, very good quarter. Wilco Drilling is announcing a dividend in respect to this quarter at $1. This has been generated from Q4 revenue of $70.9 million and a very, very good EBITDA of $54.9 million for same period. Why is that possible? Well, it's been driven by the revenue efficiency during the quarter of 98.7%. That's also in the backdrop of a very, very efficient OpEx number for the rig for the quarter, which came in at $85,300 per day per rig. Then the last highlight from the quarter is the company has a total contract backlog of, or had a total contract backlog of $511 million at the end of Q4. Those are the highlights. Let's go on now and look at the numbers in a bit more detail. That's onto section two or page seven for those of you who have the presentation, and we'll start with the Q4 2014 income statement. I'm gonna ask CFO Ian Wilson if you can walk us through the main points, Ian.
Okay. Thanks, John. Yes, the very positive revenue efficiency number of 98.7% that resulted in the contract revenue of $70.1 million, and combined with reimbursables and other revenue, a total revenue of $70.9 million. The rig operating expenses of $15.7 million, representing the $85,300 that John spoke about. On a year-to-date basis for the full year, the operating expense per day was $87,900. A little bit below the guidance that previously given, and we'll talk about future guidance at a later stage. The G&A expenses of $2.1 million, a good bit lower than the normal quarterly levels, largely attributable to a release of a surplus provision in respect of the LTIP, equivalent of $1.6 million. The G&A expense for the year is $15.7 million, including $3 million of LTIP provision for the year. We are guiding on a go-forward basis $12 million for subsequent years. Other income of $2.5 million, that is primarily in respect of settlement of an outstanding dispute. Pleased to see that at this point in time, there are no ongoing disputes, and that closes out the last dispute that we had. Depreciation very much in line with prior quarters and in line with guidance, resulting in overall expenses of $20.5 million and operating profit of $50.3 million. Interest expense also in line with prior quarters. Profit before tax of $48.2 million, with a tax expense with an effective tax rate of 19.1% of $9.2 million, with a resulting net profit of $38.9 million, equivalent to an earnings per share of $1.3, compared to full year earnings per share of $4.58. Onto the balance sheet. The rigs, machinery, and equipment, $251.2 million. Additions during the quarter were $4.2 million, offset by a depreciation charge to give an overall asset value of $251.2 million. The trade and other receivables of 12.1, that has since been received. We had in fact received early payments in respect of the November billing prior to the end of the year, hence that represents 1 month billing only. The prepayments and accrued revenue of 28.9, the bulk of that was in respect of accrued revenue, and that also all has been received since the end of the year. The cash and cash equivalent of 75.9, and current tax of 82.6. Now, the current tax receivable should be read in conjunction with the current tax payable at the bottom of the balance sheet there of 108 million. And since the end of the year, we have paid about 41 million of taxes payable and recovered 36 million, which reduces the tax asset there by the 36 million. So total assets of 458 million. Onto the lower part of the balance sheet, the long-term interest-bearing debt remains unchanged at 110 million. Our next payment due in respect to the bond is due in April. Accruals and provisions of 17.9, slightly reduced due to the decrease in the LTIP provision and the current tax payable we have spoken about. I think important to note that the next substantial tax payment that we have in respect of our overseas asset-owning entities will be in 2016. So no further tax payments in respect of that for this current year, and purely just a standard UK quarterly tax charge for the remainder of this year.
Okay, Ian, thanks, thanks for that. So let's move on to, if you have a presentation, section 3, operational update, start on page 10, which looks at Awilco Drilling's contract status. So the contract status then for the two rigs, the Will Hunter, currently has a firm contract running till the 1st of December this year. Thereafter, there are up to 275 days of options. Those options have to be declared by the 25th of February. The Will Phoenix then, we have started with the 3-year firm term contract with Apache. As part of that contract, Apache have some time to Taka and Marathon. We've actually started with Marathon, though we're expecting to hand back to the main contract holder, Apache, round about the start of the springtime. You can see on the presentation then the balance of the contract. At the end of the contract, there is up to 27 months of options. And also on the contract status slide, you can see the yard stay dates shown there currently. And current planning now is for the Will Phoenix to start early January and the Will in 2016 and the Will Hunter to start in mid-April in 16. So that's the contract status showing the timelines for the two contracts and the yard stays. So let's look at operational performance. Previously we talked about financial efficiency. This of course is driven by operational efficiency, and so really this has come then from a very good operational performance in Q4 with 99% operational uptime. In addition to that then, the OPEX, we mentioned before, Q4 is lower than guidance. There's a number of reasons for this. There's a favourable FX, but also very much an increased focus on cost discipline. So looking at our guidance going forward, we are revising this from $100,000 per day per rig to $95,000 per day per rig. Other operational highlights then, continued positive customer feedback for operations. And also operational performance, continued yard stay project planning and preparations. And I think we mentioned before in previous calls, the three important factors are planning, planning, planning. We are certainly 2 years planning now, which have been completed, and we're still 1 year away before the rigs get close to the yard. So the planning, planning, planning is still in place. But we've talked previously about the Will Phoenix now is scheduled for January 16, and the Will Hunter now is April 16. We're still planning to do both SPSs. We are, however, aware of very much a cooling market. We are very much aware of our CapEx triggers in respect to these SPSs. So moving the Will Hunter SPS back a little bit in 16 gives us a bit of flexibility should we choose to change our mind about undertaking a full SPS or the SPS at all, or provisions potentially for idle time. So very much still planning to do the SPSs, but we have a bit more flexibility on the Wheel Hunter by moving it to the right, and that's still within its SPS window. So those are the highlights on the operational performance. Let me go on to talk a little bit, or we are going on to talk a little bit about the dividend distribution. So a number of points I want to share with you. If you have page 12 on the presentation, and that's what we'll be walking through. So Ian, can you walk us through that?
Yep, as I mentioned previously, we have the dividend payable in respect of Q4 of $1, down slightly from prior quarters at $1.15, and that will be paid on around the 20th of March. Any future quarterly dividend payments will be in line with our current policy to state the intent of distributing all our cash flow above a robust cash buffer to support our working capital requirements and our planned capital expenditure, including SPS. Further point there to note that clearly the market conditions have changed quite considerably over the course of the past quarter, and the current level of the dividends will be challenged by the upcoming capital expenditures and our future market prospects.
Okay, thanks for that, Ian. So let's move on to talk about the market itself. So if you have the presentation, section 4, we'll start with page 14. 14 shows us historic day rates in the UK over sort of 15-year period. In the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a very high rates, 300 plus, 400 plus. But in this cooling market, certainly from the last quarter, which we'll go and talk a little bit more about the reasons later, but the consequences being fixtures, the most recent fixtures that we've seen in the last quarter, there have been two. One of these has been with the Ocean Valiant, which is Diamond. That's gone to Premier, and that was a fixture at $320,000 per day for that semi-submersible, and that was for two well plus a four-month option. We've also seen Paragon's midwater semi, the MSS1, and that was fixed. That was an option to an existing contract with Nexen at $224,500. So those are the last two fixtures within the quarter. Okay, we can move on and have a quick look at the UK fleet, which is page 15 of the presentation. You'll see the spread of different rigs with different drilling contractors in the UK. And comparing this slide with the slide, the similar slide from last quarter, there are quite a few changes. What are the changes? Well, first of all, you can see that one rig has actually disappeared, and that is the JW McLean, which was a Transocean. That has been scrapped, so that is the start of an attrition program by one of the drilling contractors. Then we can see there are three rigs shown in red, and the red signifies cold stacked, which is the owner committing the rig to be idle for a considerable period of time, taking the crew off, and they are not undertaking maintenance on it. So there are three rigs in the UK which have gone cold stacked. Then after that, the picture is clear about rigs coming off contracts. We can see a number of contracts terminating in 15 and some in 16. So quite a different picture to what we've seen the quarter before in terms of there's clear availability. Some rigs have been cold stacked and one rig has been sent for scrapping. So that is the rig status or the rig fleet status in the UK. Going on to page 16 then, what about the market itself? So there's been significant market change during the quarter. This is due to sharply falling oil price, and in response to that, operators in the UK and globally have reacted very quickly, very promptly, with the reductions in current and planned expenditure. So that sharp fall in oil price has triggered new behaviour by oil companies. In real terms, what does that mean? Well, in real terms, the next bullet there, number three, shows that there's a low level of rig contracting activity, a very low level of rig contracting activity at the moment. The UK government then, in the small bubble of the UKCS, they have seen this, acknowledged it, and have set up a task force to see what the government can do to help UK offshore industry and have looked at potential stimulus and tax treatment, potentially with the new measures coming in for the April budget, but nothing confirmed yet. But to summarise that point, the government has seen that there is a sort of sudden change in the market, have set up a task force in response with a view to assisting the market, but the outcome of that has not been confirmed as yet. As we talked about before, there is an increased level of rigs available in the UK. We can see that in 15 and 16. The UK still does, however, have barriers to entry in terms of any potential further influx rigs. One point on the global rig semi-submersible markets or the supply side is that some drilling contractors have now elected to undertake attrition programs. Two of the largest drilling contractors with the largest mid-water semi-sub fleets have both now announced five, six, seven rigs each, and there's potentially more in the offing. So they're looking at the oldest units, they're going for attrition, and so on a sort of medium to long-term basis, that is actually quite a positive development for mid-water drilling contractors who have operational rigs left on the supply side. So then the final point on the on slide 16 then is, as a consequence of what's happened in Q4 then, accelerated market downturn has led to increased uncertainty with respect to the market recovery. This this Q4 oil price change has sort of overtaken previous understandings of the market. Okay, moving on then. In summary, you can see page 18 of Orca Drilling announced a dividend of $1 in respect to Q4 performance. Very, very pleased about that. I'm even more pleased, though, that's been generated by very, very good revenue efficiency of 98.7%. Which was driven from the great rig operational performance and efficiencies. The company does have a very good contract backlog, $478 million, with close to 100% contract coverage through the rest of 15. Short and medium-term rig market is challenging, and the timing of the upturn is clearly uncertain now. But what is Awoko Drilling doing about it? Well, we are continuing to market ourselves in as attractive way as possible with our continued best-in-class performance and our USP of decommissioning knowledge. So that's very much a positive for us in terms of marketing. And then finally, the company does continue to evaluate market opportunities on a case-by-case basis in this changing market. So that's a summary of the Q4 earning call. I will now hand back to Raji, if you'd like to share the Q&A session.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind or wish to withdraw your question, please press star 1 again. You'll be advised when to ask your question. We have a question coming from the line of Mark Jasbeck. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Mark. Hi.
Just a quick question. For the Will Hunter, do you know if it's kind of ahead of schedule, behind schedule as far as the decommissioning program?
No. Where the Will Hunter is the Will Hunter is well ahead of the program. It's that's one of the reasons why it's such an efficient rig. So it's well understood that the number of wells will be completed before the firm term. The good news in terms of that contract, however, is that Hess are obliged to honour the firm term in terms of payment for its time. So if the rig does conclude in the middle of the summer or in the autumn before the firm term finishes, which is the 1st of December, payment in respect of the full contract value is still to be made.
Okay. And then kind of looking at the OPEX side, going forward, do you think you kind of see this favorable currency exchange rates, or are you kind of – you sort of have flexibility as far as cost deflation going forward? And if so, what are kind of the things you can move as far as the cost deflation?
I think with regard to the foreign exchange, it's difficult to predict what that's going to do. is currently sitting at 152. Our budget numbers were in the region of 160. So we do anticipate continued upside, if you like, with regard to the cost there. With cost savings, we do anticipate cost savings as a result of discussions with vendors and the increased cost saving focus for personnel on the rigs. So we believe that is sustainable. Generally, we have guided and come in slightly below guidance, and of course, over the past years demonstrated that. But there's still some inflationary increases, but we will monitor those very, very carefully and aggressively pursue cost saving opportunities.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's all I have.
Thanks, Mark.
And the next question comes from Clint Eddington. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you so much, sir.
Previously, you had discussed having a tax rate move towards the mid-teens in 2015. Are you still kind of on track to hit that level?
We are currently on track. We went through the several changes in 2014, and as a result of a change in the structure, we are in a position now where the effective tax rate is in the region of 15%. Relevant to note that there are a couple of other guidelines that have come out just in the course of the last couple of months, one relating to a change in the bareboat charter legislation once again, and also a new tax that was announced in the Autumn Statement with regard to diverted profits tax. The applicability of both of these to the drilling contracting sector as a whole has yet to be clarified, and we are in process of engaging with HM Treasury and HMRC to get that clarification. But at this point, we wait until we get that guideline confirmed and clarified.
Okay. One more question. Other than the Bolstered Dolphin, do you see any new builds still coming online in the horizon? Or do you have any visibility with that?
Well, there is one from Stena called the Stena Midmax, but I think that's targeted at Norwegian or even Arctic waters. Not too up to speed with that. And there was also some talk about CMC Raffles speculatively building some mid-water semi-submersibles in this downturn, basically to keep the yard busy. But I'm not entirely sure if that has actually materialized into a sort of financed project yet. But those are the things we've heard of. But it's certainly not the start of a new build program or campaign by contractors in terms of mid-water semis. That's the only things I've heard about recently. And again, I don't know where the mid-max is going for Stena. And the two from the CMC Raffles yard, I'm not entirely sure if that's actually turned into a real project yet, but it's reported in the press. Yeah. You'll find it, I'm sure, on Google, through Google.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
We have a question from the line of David Bush. Please go ahead.
Hello, David.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I had a question for you in regards to the 275-day option to renew the contract with Hess, if there's been any word on that at all.
Not yet, but they have until the 25th. They're obviously waiting till the very last moment. What I would say about that, just to follow on from the point, I think it was the first call I made, I think it was Mark. I think we are well ahead of the curve in terms of performance for Hess decommissioning, so it's not likely that the option will be taken to do decommissioning for their wells because it will finish ahead of time. What Hess are doing, though, is the fact that it is likely it will finish ahead of time is they're looking for a sublet opportunity, and if they do secure a sublet, it's obviously unclear how long that sublet will last for, which ironically could mean that they will need the rig longer than the firm term. So despite the fact we're going to probably finish early with decommissioning the wells, due to the fact they're looking for a sublet, it could actually require them to take some of this option time, and that's essentially why they've been waiting till the last minute to see if they can land all these balls, if you like, before they commit to two additional time.
Right. I had a question in regards to the useful life that you anticipate for the rigs in the current market conditions. How long do you think that the rigs will be able to be, you know, rented out and used before they become cold stacked or scrapped?
Okay.
Any idea at all?
So remaining fatigue life is something I can answer very easily. Remaining marketable life is something that depends on the market. So let me start with remaining fatigue life. As of 2011, when we took the rigs out of SPS in Poland in the Polish shipyard, they had a remaining fatigue life, which we agreed with the company who certified the rigs, DNV, of 20 years. Now, that was 4 years ago, which means we have 16 remaining years of fatigue life for these rigs. So, in theory, they can work for another 16 years, and potentially, when we get to the end of that 16 years, we can look at them again. In terms of marketability, clearly we look to spend money wisely and make these rigs as attractive as possible compared to the other fleet. And that is primarily the main reason why we have looked at doing additional CapEx during the yard stays, which are now planned for the very start of 16. So the yard stay projects, that just let me remind you, they're $20 million each per rig. But over and above that, we are planning on spending $45 million between the two rigs on two BOPs. And basically, this is to help make the rigs as marketable as possible compared to the existing fleet. So fatigue life, we've got 16 years to go. Marketability life, it depends on how well we market these and how attractive they are to customers. And one way of making them attractive to customers is by renewing equipment such as the BOPs. And may I point out, the other way of making ourselves as attractive to customers is to continue with the very good operations that we've been achieving so far.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
We have a question from the line of David Shahanian. Please go ahead.
Hello, David.
Hello. Good morning. Congratulations on the strong quarter.
Thank you.
My question was on the Hess contract. If they choose not to renew and they don't get a sublet, what is the plan? Are you going to move the yard stay closer, or are we going to see it warm stacked? What is the plan there?
So at the moment, we're planning to do the SPS project. We're still continuing with our planning. We do understand there is quite a lot of CapEx required in advance of the SPS during the calendar year of 2015. So what we're doing at the moment, we're still planning for this SPS of the rig, but at the same time watching the market very carefully, taking a view on it, and should we get to a point when we have to make a commitment to significant trigger dates for CapEx, we can take a view to continue speculatively, or we could take a view on warm stacking the rig. That is not a decision we've taken yet. We have still have time to make that decision. But we're clearly aware of the market, and at the moment we can do either. And moving the Will Hunter further to the right, as you'll see in page 15 of the presentation, moving it further to the right then gives us a little bit more time to watch the market and make the best decision for the company.
Right. Okay. And just in the current market conditions, do you think it is prudent to reconsider the capital allocation program in terms of maybe repurchasing AWOCO shares or conserving cash to focus on investment opportunities?
Well, we have made a commitment to distribute free cash. Buying shares could be an option, but at the moment I think the priority is to conserve cash for capital commitments, but it's certainly something we regularly look at and monitor, and it could be an option in the future. But at the moment, we're concentrating on planning for the SBSs and keeping on top of these budgets and conserving cash for that.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers. Okay.
The next question comes from the line of Alexander Starhill. Please go ahead.
Hello, Alexander.
Yes, hello guys. Thanks for the presentation and for the good quarter. My question is with regard to the market and your cost and how you would position yourself vis-a-vis the market. Mainly in terms of OPEX, you described your OPEX for 2015. How would you describe the OPEX of some of your competitors as far as you can see? obviously some of them have higher interest costs, so you should have a slight advantage, but I'm not sure about the equipment you have on board compared to the rest of the UK market. Can you talk a little bit about that, how well you are positioned to get the next contract?
Well, I think we're positioned to get the next contract. It's not necessarily on our OPEX. It's to do with our best commercial offering, and probably more importantly, on our operational offering, our uptime, our safety statistics, etc., our USP of our unique selling point of all the decommissioning knowledge that we have. So those are the things that will help us secure a contract. But going back to your question about OPEX, how do we compare to our competitors? The actual OPEX, now we guided 100 and we brought it back to 95. The OPEX between the majority of rigs in the UK will be similar because they're a similar vintage rig. In most cases, about half of the OPEX is to do with the crew, and most of the rigs have similar size crew and pay similar kind of money. And the other half is to do with insurance and maintenance, etc. And again, those activities are broadly similar. So I wouldn't expect the OPEX of our competitors to be dramatically different. So it might be plus or 10% between them. Where the differences pop up are things like SG&A, shore-based support. We have a very modest operation and therefore a very modest cost. Also, where differences quite often occur is the annual capex that we spend. Now, we guide, we spend 16, that's $8 million per rig per year, and then, of course, we do an SPS every 5 years. Some competitor drilling companies spend a lot less in capex every year, but what they tend to do then is load their five-yearly SPS with a much bigger cost. So, again, what that tells you is the costs are broadly the same for these similar kind of rigs, but some people do it in slightly different ways. The big saving for us is it's a very small organization. There's no management fees, and the SG&A is pretty modest.
Yeah, I see that, and that's certainly one of the big reasons why we like you guys. Now, just going back then on what you just concluded, does it then make sense, and that's a question I don't know the answer, but does it make sense then to reserve capex for upgrading equipment, as you just described, between the two rigs, 45 million roughly, when you actually only compete on price?
Well, in a lean market, which we're certainly in, and it looks like it's unless something changes, it's going to become leaner. We need to position ourselves as best as possible, and having two new BOPs, one BOP on each rig, will certainly stand us in good stead for that. And as well as having new equipment, which is attractive to operators, what I would also say is that the number one source of downtime on these kind of rigs is to do the BOPs. So by buying new BOPs as well as offering new equipment, it helps to mitigate the risk of downtime for one, for a local drilling, but two, also for their customers, again, making us even more attractive to them. So I think this money is very well spent, but there's also a sort of side story, and that is that legislation has changed quite dramatically recently to do with BOPs, mostly driven by the Macondo incident. And so operating old BOPs in the future is becoming harder because of increased legislation on it and, indeed, a very strict customer preference for new BOPs from some of the major operators. So it stands us in good stead, and in some respects it's a necessity to spend this money on the two BOPs.
Okay, I understand that. And then maybe can you just talk for a moment about the decommissioning market, which, we all read about, and it seems that's an important part of your future, but can you talk whether that's already making a difference in terms of demand?
It's a very small part of demand, though it has the potential to have a large portion of it. Essentially, every operator in the UK has some old wells which have been depleted and passed their useful life, and therefore they are obliged, they're legally required to go back to these wells and decommission them. And in very simple terms, what that means is make them safe, drill some of the production casing out, mill some of the production casing out, put some cement plugs in, make them safe environmentally. So there's a large number of wells that the drilling can, that the operators have to go back and make safe. There's a very, very small percentage of these have actually been made safe or decommissioned. And so there is a significant opportunity for decommissioning in the future. At the moment, the UK government hasn't set any specific dates to the oil companies for decommissioning, which is a bit of a shame for us. But what I would say is that in a market that has rigs where there's higher availability and clearly some more competitive pricing, if the operators did have capital budgets for this, this would be the time for them to undertake this considerable program of work.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just that obviously all of these companies try to conserve cash. Now, is there a chance that the UK government participates in the capital expenditure?
The UK government has to. They are obliged to pay a percentage, and I believe the percentage is 50. It might be 55. It's certainly at least 50% of the decommissioning cost.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big incentive by the UK government to push decommissioning activity, one on an environmental basis, but more importantly to them, or as importantly to them, on a financial basis, because there's a win-win here for the Treasury to undertake this work with lower-priced assets.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome. Thanks, Alexander.
And the next question comes from the line of Sebastian Solsloff. Please go ahead.
Hello, Sebastian.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Guys, I just wanted to follow up on two questions which have been raised before. The first one would be the capital allocation strategy. I mean, you stated that you want to distribute the excess cash to shareholders, but how does, for instance, the bond side compare to that? I mean, we see the bond prices at, some would even say, depressed or distressed levels. What are your thoughts on that?
You can answer a question for a change, Ian. Yes, on you go.
Okay, thanks, Sebastian. I did receive the question that you sent in. With regard to potential bond buyback, I mean, certainly we've seen the bond pricing come down over the last several months, and we are aware of the market to the extent that we've got visibility of the market, but obviously there's another market out there that we don't necessarily have visibility. But any buyback, just the same as a share buyback program, that's something that would ultimately be a board decision. And at this point in time, we've been consistent with distributing our available cash back to shareholders. But we continue to assess and monitor what the possibilities are. And the board, we believe, have demonstrated good financial judgment over the last several years, and their interests are to protect all the stakeholders, so shareholders, bondholders, employees, clients, vendors. So we continue to monitor, and the ultimate decision will be what we believe is in the best interests of the company.
Okay, thank you. And then on the upcoming SPSSs and the additional BOPs you are planning to put on the rigs, could you remind us, please, what amount you have already prepaid on these projects? If I recall correctly, there have been some.
Let me give a wee summary, and then you'll come into the. So the BOPs are, it's $45 million for two. Out of that 45, $20 million is for the actual BOPs themselves. That is $10 million per BOP. And then the missing $25 million is for all the stuff that you need to make them work, the new handling systems, the control systems, and blah, blah, blah. So that's the $45 million split, $25 million on the bits, and $20 million for the actual BOP. So how much have we spent out of those 45 years? I think that's a question.
Yeah, out of the 45, spent in the region of $10 million, and that's been the initial stage payments for the body of the BOP for the steelwork. So there's been several stage payments made in respect of that.
Okay.
Okay, so how much do you still owe on these?
So the, as for the for the BOPs themselves, we've paid 10 out of the 20 million for those, and we've spent nothing on the 25 million required for the handling systems and the control systems, etc.
Okay, I see.
Yes, and our current guidance for 2015 is 25 million. We've stated that previously. That has not changed, with a further 10 million in 2016. And, of course, timing of that may change to some extent, depending on timing of delivery of the BOPs, but that's the remaining spend.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. And then, lastly, accounting question. You have these tax liabilities on the balance sheet, current tax payable. What's the background behind that? If I see it correctly, it's over 100 million. Is that turning into cash at some point, or i.e. cash outflow, or is it an accounting?
What we have is an asset and a liability. So the liability at the end of the year was 100 million, and the asset we have significantly.
It's 80.
Yeah, 82. So that's a large portion of that is in respect of the tax liability for the overseas asset owning entities. And as part of the process there, we have a tax liability, but offsetting that is a recoverable amount that we can obtain recovery of within a matter of weeks after the payment of that tax. So, in fact, in January, we paid a liability of 41 million, and within 10 days, we had the recovery of 36 million. The next payment that we have in respect of that particular liability is in 2016, and that payment will be required to be done before the end of quarter two. But once again, there'll be a cash outlay. And then a cash recovery as well.
And that's the standard process for that particular
yes.
Jurisdiction.
Yep.
But eventually the delta between the liability and the receivable will turn into an outflow then, or?
Yes, the net difference, absolutely. That's the tax provision that we have. So it would be nice and easy to net off the assets receivable against liability, but from an accounting and reporting point of view, we separate the two.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
We currently have no questions coming through. Just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. We have a question coming from the line of Fred Stang. Please go ahead.
Hello, Fred.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Given the current units, given the large numbers of units coming off contract through 2015 and the current demand situation, I believe it's safe to assume that it will be hard competition for both P&A programs and regular drilling programs. Obviously, you have a long experience with P&I, so my question is, if there is something technical features with your rigs that makes them more attractive for P&A compared to other units?
So are our rigs different in any way to the competitor fleet for P&A? Work, I think your question was. You're very faint on the phone line there, so I think that's what the question you asked. Essentially, there are some small changes, but not fundamental changes. The Will Hunter is a third generation drilling rig, which you can still drill holes. It just so happens it's been decommissioning wells for the last 2 years. During the last 2 years, the rig has become modified with the small changes to handling systems and setups, etc. So it very much is now set up in an optimum way for P&A, but it's not designed in a different way to a standard drilling rig. The big plus really is the fact that Wilco Drilling has built up so much knowledge. The crew has built up so much knowledge in conjunction with Hess that the operation has become extremely efficient and has beaten all of the schedules and the predictions of Hess. So it's some changes to the rig, though relatively relatively minor, but it's the knowledge of the company and the crew that have made this an extremely efficient and very attractive unit to a customer who would like to undertake a decommissioning program. So it very much does have a USP, a unique selling point, but probably loaded more on the experience side rather than the equipment side.
Thank you. You mentioned modifications. Would those modifications make it make any difficulties with resuming a regular drilling program?
No, none at all. None at all.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have a question coming from the line of Ben Keller. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Hello, Ben.
Just to follow up on someone's question on the opportunity with regard to decommissioning, there was a press release this week about Shell seeking approval from the government. One, do you have any idea what the timing is on that? And two, do you have any idea or insight on the size of that opportunity?
No. but what I can tell you is that Shell have been talking about their Brent field, which is a series of very large platforms, which are 30 years old-ish, maybe a little bit older. These are the rigs which are attached to the seabed, either with large steel jackets or concrete legs. So these are the permanent fixtures you would see in the North Sea if you were to fly over it. So the decommissioning that Shell have been talking about recently is not necessarily well decommissioning. It's talking about decommissioning of these very, very large platforms, which requires large barges, etc. There are, of course, wells attached to these platforms, but they would normally be decommissioned with a platform rig which would sit on the platform. The only potential work that a drilling contractor like Awilco Drilling could get from Shell decommissioning, if it is the Brents you're talking about, is if there are any satellite wells, some tieback templates sitting on the seabed close to these platforms, which are tied in by a pipeline. So I wouldn't say relatively modest, but it would be a smaller decommissioning task than the big platform decommissioning. It's the same word, it's decommissioning, but I think the press release you're talking about is decommissioning these big platforms rather than just traditional subsea wells as we are doing for Hess.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
And the next question comes from the line of Alexander Starrell. Please go ahead.
Hello again, Alexander.
Hi again, guys. One more follow-up question on the market. Have you guys, by coincidence, received any information from clients how they look at oil price and when they would be willing to take on more risk in terms of drilling? What's their view for the North Sea?
Yeah, good question. Very good question. So I would say that most clients and quite a lot of analysts and observers had a general consensus on what oil price looked like, and let's call it the oil price recovery looked like in Q3. Then as we moved through Q4 and the oil price changed very quickly and dramatically. It went from sort of 100 down to where we were in January, hitting 45. Happened dramatically and very quickly. Pretty much all of the observers and the operators took a slightly different view on what they thought the recovery is going to look like in terms of it might take 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It might be U-shaped, V-shaped, volatile. Oil price might be 20, might be 200. There was consensus. Now there isn't consensus. So what that tells us is that every operator or most operators have a slightly different view on it. And at the moment, what they are saying, which is the same, is there's increased uncertainty, which is making it difficult to make decisions. Some of the operators in the North Sea are countercyclic, but most of them are in that place. That increased uncertainty makes it harder for them to make capex or just general decisions about investment. So that's really the summary of where we are.
Okay, so I guess what you're saying is not so much what the absolute price is at the moment and their view, but much more about whether the recovery is V-shaped or U-shaped, and therefore they get more hesitant if they feel it's U-shaped.
I wouldn't even say it's what shape is it. I think there's just increased uncertainty, and this uncertainty needs to reduce a bit in terms of just to make these decisions. To allow them to make these decisions.
Okay.
There are a lot of moving parts in this.
That makes sense. But just I was hoping for a hard number, but obviously it's hard to.
Well,
know.
The operators used to have a hard number, the world's changed since then.
Okay, but then can you tell us how long does it usually take to drill a well and get the oil out of the ground from start to finish? How much time do they need before to make such a decision to plan in their business plan?
Well, I can't give you a hard number. I can't give you a rule of thumb. There's a very large range, and if you're talking about mid-water semi-submersible wells, you could drill a short well in 30 days. A lot of wells are 90 days. You can get wells that are considerably longer than that, or planned longer than that. Then, of course, you add in all the risk of things like downhole problems, things going wrong, weather, blah, blah, blah. So really there's a huge range of how long it takes to drill a well. And then you said, how long does it take to drill that well and get the revenue from it? Well, of course, that well then has to obviously be connected to some infrastructure so you get the oil on shore and start to sell it. So it's very much dependent on the type of well and if there's any infrastructure in place to receive it. So it's kind of almost how long is a piece of string. But how long does it take on a really average mid-water semi-sub well? You could say 90 days just to drill the well. That's a real sort of mid-range number.
Okay, that's helpful. And then you mentioned warm stacking potentially, Rick. Can you just explain quickly what that means in terms of numbers?
So if we're operational, that's costing us $95,000. We're now guiding at $95,000 a day. If we were to go hot stack, that is basically the same number. You keep everybody on the rig. If you go warm stack, what you do then is you bring the rig to some sheltered waters and you reduce your cost. And you reduce your cost in terms of some maintenance activity, some project work, numbers of people are reduced, etc. And if you want to take a really sort of rough number, you could say that warm stack would half your OPEX. That's a really rough number. Now, that's warm stack. There is no strict definition of what a warm stack is, so then you could come up with variants of that, like lukewarm stack, which is an even smaller number. It's basically your appetite for risk. The last version of stack in your range is cold stack, and cold stack basically is everybody off, weld the doors shut, switch the lights off, walk away from it. And before you do that, you do a sort of preservation type activity, but once that's done, you're off and there's nobody on that rig again. And to get that rig working again means you have to do a reactivation program. And when the rig is reactivated, there's some inherent risk because the rig just hasn't worked or hasn't been maintained for a period of time. So what cold stack means is that you're committing usually to a long time. It's usually the last rig to be picked for a job as a cold stack rig because it usually comes with a bit more risk when it goes for its first contract, its first program. If all rigs were the same in terms of performance, hot rigs would be picked first, warm rigs would be picked next, and then cold rigs would be picked last. That's a kind of overview of it.
Okay, makes sense. Thank you.
We have no further questions. I will hand back to your host to conclude today's conference.
Okay, Ranji, thank you very much for organizing the call, and I would just like to say thank you to the listeners and the participants for the Wilco Drilling Q4 2014 earnings call. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's conference. You may now replace your handsets. Thank you.